From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them big
The war over Bush's new plan for Iraq. Plus, surprise, Arnold shakes up the national health care debate. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and columnist for Fortune magazine, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of the political spectrum from San Francisco, his usual haunt, is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the San Francisco Chronicle, editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com, and author of the book Playing President. On the right from Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, editorial page editor and columnist for The Washington Times and author of the book The West's Last Chance, Will We Win the Clash of Civilizations? Arianna Huffington is away today. A big week, obviously. President Bush addressing the nation with his new plan for Iraq. The debate already has become, at week's end as we go to air, quite vocal and violent. The debate over language, whether this is a surge or, as the Democrats would call it, an escalation, has been framed. Why don't we start? I think people know the general dimensions here. Tony, what did you make of the president's speech, and what interests you about the early reaction, and where's this headed?
Well, the speech was predictably, and I and many other people predicted, was not going to have any big or measurable impact on public opinion, and it didn't, which is fairly singular for a major presidential address. The president is in a perilous political position. He's not quite inexorably dysfunctional, but is moving fairly quickly toward that. The measure of that is going to be how many Republicans in the Senate and in the House vote with the Democratic resolution to oppose the president's new strategies or the policies he's announced this week. My guess is that it can easily be a loss of 12 Republican senators, and if Senator Warner should go the wrong way, then it could open a floodgate. You might only see 24 Republican senators standing with him below the veto override level. I think the vote in the House will be very close to veto override. That is 50, 60, 70 Republican congressmen voting with the Democrats. And the president will be completely isolated. I think the danger that follows there domestically is that when a president loses the support of his fellow party men and women decisively in Washington, and if he still has fight in him, then we move towards, not necessarily inexorably, but we possibly move towards sort of a constitutional stress when he presses his point with no visible political support in town. I think that's what, unless his proposal and the execution of it in Baghdad works sufficiently well, the public begins to give him a bit more time, I think we're moving to that zone by the summertime.
Bob, what do you make of it?
Well, I thought the speech was dishonest in the extreme, and my support for that I draw from a brilliant columnist who knows the Republicans as well as anyone, my colleague here, Tony Blankley. And he says, I'm quoting, and hopefully this is already posted on TruthDig. I don't know what the Washington Times website, but it's a column worth reading because he also takes the Democrats to task for not doing the one thing they could do, which is to threaten some of the funding. And I think very effectively disposes of the Democratic lie that you can't cut increased funding for troops because, in fact, you can, and he knows the Congress. But on the Republicans and on Bush in particular, I think Tony got it right, and I'm going to quote from him. He says, the expected troop increase in Iraq is not a surge being transient, sudden rise. There is no plausible military theory which would rely on a brief increase in troop strength followed by the immediate withdrawal of such troops from Iraq. The troops would, and then he goes on to say, the troops would have to be there for an indefinite period. And we are talking about, really, he doesn't say this now, I will editorialize, we're talking about the Vietnamization of the conflict. And the most charitable thing to be said about it is he's trying to stick it to a future president, which was left to Nixon, who unfortunately didn't do it. He also escalated the war to get us out of Bush's mess. But Bush has made it very clear he's not going to deal in a forthright way with this problem, and he's going to get more Americans and Iraqis killed.
What does there's been you listen to different reactions, and you could imagine if the stakes were the way the president described it in the speech, which is that if we were to withdraw, it would be a calamity that would be a disaster for the United States. How can you explain a sincere, if that's sincere, how can Bush not be asking for something much more than 20,000 troops? This is the disconnect I don't understand, because I have no way of thinking about this as anything but him throwing kind of a politically acceptable small Hail Mary to run out the clock until it's another president's problem. If he believed what he says, why wouldn't he be doing something much bigger? And doesn't that mean that this just isn't serious, Tony?
Well, look, I mean, I agree. I support and continue to support and think we need to prevail over the years in Iraq and the region. And I'm prepared to support much more raising of troops to do the job. But those of us who have been supporting the president, been complaining for years that he's not been putting sufficient resources, military, political, diplomatic, communications, to the American people, to support the challenge that matches the danger that I think the president correctly describes. Now, sadly, neither are the Democrats generally. And there was a very revealing interview in the Washington Post today with Rahm Emanuel, a report of an interview by David Ignatius, in which Emanuel expressly says that they're not going to try to help, that they're not going to focus on a solution for Iraq. That's the president's problem. They just and that's, I'm afraid, where we are politically, is the Democrats are going to desperately try to let this thing just completely fail on the president's watch.
What's the are you going to support this even though you think it's inadequate? Or are you going to?
Yes, it's clearly inadequate, but it's not implausible that it might succeed in substantially reducing violence in Baghdad for a while. And then and these are very conditional qualifications, if the politics in Iraq are capable of rising to that occasion and working out something with the Sunnis, we have a small fractional chance of success. And I think it's worth taking it because the next step is merely to try to contain a full-blown civil war within the borders of Iraq, which means, I think, sending a division to the border with Iran, brigades up to the Turkish border to keep the Turks out, brigades down to Jordan to protect Jordan from the infestation of the civil war in Iraq, and just trying to contain the civil war within Iraq and not letting the whole Mideast blow up. Now, that's such a dreadful prospect. I'm willing to take, I think, the risk with American lives in combat, I regret to say, to see if this plan can work. And it's got some chance. I don't think it's 50-50, but it's got some measurable chance.
How do you, Bob, I want to get you back into this, but I've become, suddenly I've been watching Charlie Rose lately because it's another place where you can see, one of the few places actually I find where you can see at least people talking for longer than sound bites about this, from the different points of view. And I mean, you look at Chuck Hagel on this, the Republican who may himself toss his hat in the presidential ring. You look at John Burns, the fabulous New York Times reporter who's been on Charlie Rose a bunch talking about his own reporting there. And you get this, everybody hopes this could work. That's, everyone would like to pray that this could work. But it seems like the universal sense is that it's too little too late. And it's unless you somehow think that General Petraeus is kind of a magician, Bob. Is there something that anyone's missing here? Or you share that, I guess, right? But I guess the question is...
come on. No, I don't share that. I don't think it's too little too late. I think it was a stupid thing to do. I think they blew up Iraq, and now you have to figure out how you get out, and they tell us the way to do it is to compound the error, to do the very same thing that got you into this problem. And there is precedent. We're not allowed to talk somehow about Vietnam, but this is how we got deeper into Vietnam. We started out with a fairly small commitment, and everybody said, we're not doing enough. And yes, Nixon came along, we'll do even more than Lyndon Johnson did, and you end up with a result that the 3.4 million Indochinese killed, according
according to Robert McNamara, and a result that you could have had 20 years earlier. So I don't accept the premise that somehow our presence, our military presence in Iraq is producing stability or is a necessary ingredient to peace. I think the Iraqis have got to be allowed to make their own history for better or worse. That's my view. And that we can supply humanitarian aid. We can supply wisdom in drawing up a constitution if they ask. But the idea that somehow increased U.S. military presence is going to make the situation better or is essential, I just don't accept. But I think there's an even more basic issue raised by Tony's column, and that is honesty. And Tony says the President Bush will not tell the American people what he really wants to do there, which is to send more troops permanently. You know, that's really what the plan is here. And if permanent is going too far, Tony, let me anticipate that. You say for a long haul and a lot more troops. And that's the Vietnamization of the conflict. And that's what the president's not willing to do. So we really have a basic issue here of honesty. And we have a profoundly dishonest president. I also want to make one other point here that a course has been taken here not to bring in the Sunnis. They would not have turned over Saddam Hussein to Sadr, in effect, to be hung and stabbed in the throat and everything else, where they'd at least been interested in reaching out to the old Baath Sunnis and so forth. They're not interested in that. And what is going to happen now is our troops are going to be used to consolidate the power of Shiite theocrats in Iraq. That's what they're going to be used for.
Go ahead, Tony.
Let me reclaim my column just briefly. Inadvertently, I think you slightly overinterpret what I wrote. Not much. Yes, I think the use of the word surge is dishonest, and I said so in so many words. I do think that the inevitable logic of this is to keep the troops there longer. I do not think, as you suggested I might think, that the president has an explicit plan to increase even more. I think there's an element of hope, maybe unjustified hope in his mind, that 20 or 30,000 will do the job. And so the only zone of dishonesty that I'm attributing to the president is the use of the word surge and the concept of temporary regarding those 20 or 25,000.
Tony, let me ask you this. Sorry, you want to finish the thought?
No,
that was it. Let me ask you this question, because this, as I struggle, and I know lots of other folks out there are struggling with how to think about this, how do you assess whether it's a fallacy that it will be a calamity if we pull out? In other words, you know, that was thought to be the arguments in other situations, and is it possible you're wrong and the president's wrong that it will be as bad as we think or the worst of all possible outcomes?
Yes, look, of course, nobody can predict, and everybody's guessing based on levels of knowledge they have, but the most knowledgeable people guess wrong. Obviously, most nations that start losing wars guess wrong about the outcome in good faith. They think they're going to win. The Germans thought they were going to win. Nobody can predict, but an awful lot of experts who are not supporters of the president think there's a high likelihood that if civil war breaks out completely and we're not there to contain it in any way, that Turkey will be sucked into Kurdistan, that Syria will be lapping over to support the Shias, that the Saudis, the Egyptians, and other Sunni countries will be giving more and more support to the beleaguered Sunni 20%. And in the middle of all this, of course, is little Israel, which, according to the London Times last week, a paper that's of some repute, having been in business for a few centuries, that they have a plan, not necessarily that they're planning to execute, but they have a plan to use nuclear weapons to destroy Iran's nuclear capabilities. Now, you can't, you know, plus 19 million barrels of oil flowing through the Hormuz Straits, keeping the world economy functioning, all in jeopardy. The Saudi oil fields, which are, unfortunately for the Saudis, although it's a Sunni country, the Shias happen to live on top of the Saudi oil. There's danger there. So that is the most inflammable possible setting. Now, maybe we'll get lucky and none of that will happen and it'll just be an ugly business for the Iraqis for 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years. But my fear and a lot of people's fear is what I've described. And while we don't know whether it will happen, an awful lot of experts think it's plausible.
Up ahead, more in Iraq, plus Arnold's big healthcare plan. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Scheer is with me on the left in San Francisco. Tony Blankley in Washington on the right. We're talking about Iraq and Bush's new plan and the reaction that is kicking up. Bob, what do you make of, I asked Tony to sort of examine his own premise that withdrawing is a calamity and therefore, you know, we must do something bigger or at least this. How do you assess, possible fallacy in your own thinking on this or your side of the argument? What could happen if we do what you say and sort of pull out reasonably quickly in some way? And does the other side have a point, or some folks have a point, like General Zinni, who is an opponent of the war, saying that if we do pull out in a quick way and withdraw, we're going to find ourselves back in there in a bigger way within 2 or 3 years? How do you assess that?
Well, first of all, I don't know about this word quick. I mean, don't have to pull out the way we did in Vietnam, because there we pulled out because we failed so totally militarily that we had to lift people from the roofs of embassies. We have the power to have an orderly withdrawal. If Democrats are talking in the Pelosi Reid letter, 4 to 6 months, and you stand down, you don't do it in 24 hours, and you get your troops out of harm's way, and you provide whatever material support you feel you're obligated to have provided. You leave it there. You provide humanitarian aid and so forth. You facilitate those who want to leave, so they don't have to. We don't have to repeat the boat people thing. You allow those who've been allied with you to leave the country. You let them move to Michigan or wherever they want to move. We have precedent for that. So it is not a question of chaos and disintegration in 24 hours. That would not make no sense at all. But listening to Tony's description of the calamity, first of all, my first response is, my God, who are these criminals in our government who allowed this to happen by getting rid of Saddam Hussein? I mean, if the whole Mideast is now going to crumble, and all of these horrible, the Shiite forces and so forth. We had a defanged dictator there who was contained, who was not a threat to anyone. And so if I would accept Tony's view of what has been unleashed in the Mideast, my God, we ought to have impeachment hearings now and nothing less. How did this disaster, was this disaster allowed to happen? But I would say there's also a precedent. I happened to listen to the Australian foreign minister yesterday in Los Angeles, and I got into a little exchange with him. And it's interesting. He now talks about Australia backed us in the Vietnam War and sent troops. And yet Richard Nixon had the wisdom to go meet with Mao Zedong, then a bloody communist dictator, and normalize relations. All of the predictions for accommodating China or accepting, letting the Chinese make their own history, which unfortunately he did not apply to Vietnam, none of that turned out to be true. And there's the Australian foreign minister yesterday making jokes about, yeah, they're communists in Vietnam and China, but all they want to do is trade and so forth. So you have exactly the opposite of what was supposed to have happened, the great calamity. And my feeling is, if you look around at intervention, military intervention, as opposed to diplomacy and other efforts, it seems to me that far higher risk are with the military intervention. And we have accommodated quite a few people. We get along with Libya now, for God's sake, you know. I don't see why we can't get along with Iran. I think the message of the Baker Commission was, we can get along with Syria and Iran. We got to stop demonizing all these countries. We got to recognize we have our differences. They have a common stake in instability in the region. The Shiites and Sunnis got along quite well in Iraq for a long time, and they weren't particularly given to religious fanaticism. That's an element we helped usher in, and we had this fantasy somehow the Shiites would be good Shiites and be our Shiites and not follow the Iranians, and that turned out to be a disaster. And all I'm saying is, you've got to let the Iraqis make their own history. And the idea that our country, where we don't even have a command of their language, we don't know their religion, somehow by throwing in more young men, Americans into that situation to be, targets, is going to make it better, is, I think, absurd. One last thing. Go Bob, see the movie Battle of Algiers, because that was the French argument for holding on Algeria. Does anybody talk about Algeria now in those terms?
Let's talk for a second about the presidential, how this plays into presidential politics. Tony, start with the Republicans. I mean, McCain is obviously a supporter of escalation and wanted more, but I think Giuliani is supporting this. Romney, I think, in a low-key way, has supported it. Are they all So is everybody supporting this who's running on the Republican side? And what does that mean?
No, no, Hagel is not.
Right.
Now, I'd never thought much of Hagel as a national candidate, not because he's not intelligent and attractive and a Vietnam War vet. I mean, he's got all the profile, smart man, self-made, you know, millionaire, I think, but because I just didn't think he had any particular niche in the Republican Party. But if the Iraq War goes as badly as so many people expect, Hagel, who is otherwise a pretty solid conservative on the other issues, tax cuts, et cetera, and being probably the strongest voice of opposition to the war amongst those who are presidential aspirants, might just possibly get a leg up. And obviously McCain, who is the front runner, will have to explain himself in some way. Now, he can justify it, and I think very legitimately, that he'd been calling, as I and others had, for years for more troops, and we got too little too late, if that's what it turns out. I'm not convinced it has turned out that way. But so he can explain his position legitimately, but obviously it's a deficit out of which he'd have to work his way. Giuliani, I don't think his position on the war is significant one with the other. He's playing, you know, his strength is his mayoral performance before and, of course, during September 11th.
Bob, how do you see the Democrats? You know, you've got Edwards, who's sort of on the, I would say, is the most aggressive for withdrawal now. Obama, at this point, is sort of finessing a bit. Obviously didn't support the war, doesn't support the surge, but also talks about not doing something precipitous in terms of withdrawal. And Hillary Clinton is where, probably a little to the right of that, I guess, because she's obviously supported the original intervention, but has had lots of concerns about the precipitous withdrawal, doesn't support this surge either. How do you see this playing on the Democratic presidential side?
Well, I think they do have to fish or cut bait. I mean, there's no middle road position here, no triangulation that will work. The voters have spoken. They want the war ended. And Tony, again, bring up his column, but his description of what the Democrats are trying to do or not doing is right on the money, because Tony knows how Congress works. He knows conditions can be put on funding. He knows that there are votes to be taken, that they can cut funds. They're not going to cut funds for troops that are there now, so they aren't safe. And but they certainly can tie up funds in the future to escalate the war. And that's the power of Congress, and everybody understands that. And I think his column makes that clear. So Democrats are going to be on the spot. And I can tell you for sure, having seen the demonstrations here in San Francisco just yesterday, Pelosi is not going to sell out on this issue. She's just not going to. It's in her gut and in her brain, and she's going to push it. And the Democrats are going to have to do more than posture, and they can't just say, oh, we'll let this hang around you know, Bush's neck. It's not going to work as a strategy. And you mentioned Edwards. I think Edwards right now is emerging as a very, very strong candidate, precisely because he's clear on this issue. But when you got somebody like Hagel saying, calling this a dangerous foreign policy blunder, maybe we'll get some people switching over to the Republicans if they start making sense. You know, you put a reasonable Republican up there, maybe we'll get some bipartisan politics for a change.
Let's talk about on the domestic side. We only got a couple minutes left, but a big development this week in California. Arnold Schwarzenegger put out what by any measure is maybe the most ambitious healthcare plan, calling for universal coverage, requiring people to have health coverage, providing subsidies for low-income people, and actually providing, though he doesn't call them taxes, because Republicans would never call any financing plan a tax, he puts in things that are, you know, fees on employers who don't offer coverage, the old pay-or-play kind of approach, as well as taxes on providers, or he calls them rebates or something, but fees on doctors and hospitals to help finance coverage for everyone. This has set off in the healthcare world, which I follow closely. It's just an amazing shockwave that it sent through. And at least for me and Bob, I wanted to pass it off to you in a sec. But the thing that strikes me, one is, first, if Schwarzenegger were able to run for president, it's already transforming the national healthcare debate. If he were actually someone who could run and he can't, it would be sort of earth-shaking. But beyond that, it also sort of brings up the disconnect, which is kind of depressing to me in terms of democracy, between governing and campaigning, because all you heard during the campaign from Arnold was it would never raise taxes, never, never, no, 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 and sort of crucifying Phil Angelides, the Democrat, for wanting to do things like raise taxes to fund health care for everyone. And then Arnold turns around, and not in quite the way Angelides would have done it, but puts out this ambitious, fabulous, as he calls it, postpartisan approach that makes you think listening to campaigns isn't useful. Only got him out a minute, Bob, but just start around the horn quickly.
I don't agree. Arnold got spanked by the nurses and the cops and everybody else in California, and by the voters. And when his initiatives failed and he moved to the center, he's brought in new people into his administration. And I agree with you. I think this is far-reaching. This is on 3 points. One is that it extends care to immigrants, and that will really wipe out the Republican yahoos and even those in the Democratic Party. It says particularly immigrant children need to be taken care of. It's cost effective. It's the right thing to do. He doesn't just deal with poor people. He's talking about people who make 300% of the poverty rate and extending health care to them. The only failure of his program is his 4% corporate contribution for those who don't supply medical, and even the CEO of Safeway, who supports the plan and contribute to it, said that's not enough. But I think the Schwarzenegger thing should be applauded by all, and I think the Democrats will increase that 4% to make it a better program. But I think it's the way to go. And again, maybe it's the beginning of bipartisan foreign policy. We need universal health care. The corporations need it, and Schwarzenegger's taking the lead and should be commended for it.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Just about 15 seconds for all. Tony Blankley, it is your soapbox.
A quick premonition. Hillary Clinton's going to Iraq this weekend. My premonition tells me she's going to come back an anti-war leader.
Robert Scheer.
Well, I just want to take my 15 seconds to applaud Minister McCauley in Nigeria, who has the Rainbow Church and has taken this bold step. He's being threatened with excommunication by his father, who had ordained him, who was a major leader in the Anglican Church there. But, recognition, here's the father who's condemning homosexuality. Here's the son who's also ordained me, saying, I am a homosexual and I'm proud of it. And I'm really happy to see sanity come to the church.
For those of you who are vulnerable to third party temptation, there is a must-read article in the new issue of the Atlantic Monthly on a group called Unity 08 that's been started by several aging political consultants who have been depressed by the incredibly partisan turn that is partly the result of their own handiwork over the decades. And they have designed a web-based strategy that's going to, they're going to get a Unity 08 third party qualified on the ballot in their plan is for all 50 states. And in a web-based way, permit the a draft of a candidate who, if they don't suit the particular litmus test of either side, could become a force in the next election. Read it. That's all the reading we got time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to my co-hosts Robert Scheer and Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our engineer Steve Herbert at KCRW, with our technical director J.C. Swadek. A big thanks to Sports Byline in San Francisco and WAMU in Washington, D.C. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
You got pajamas.
Well, we know we need each other, so we better call a colleague.
For more information about Left, Right, and Center, or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z. For questions and comments, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.